Welcome to the weekend. I'm Angela Kocherga. On this episode, we continue our series of conversations about COVID-19. We're taking a closer look at some of the issues and disparities exposed by the pandemic with the help of authors, historians, and researchers. This is not the first time the borderland has had to cope with a deadly virus. Just ahead, historian David Romo talks about the 1918 Spanish flu. What lessons have we learned? But first, a story about an essential worker, an El Paso nurse caring for COVID-19 patients in intensive care. He also took care of patients wounded in the Walmart mass shooting last summer. That nurse is among 30,000 healthcare professionals who are also DACA recipients. August 3rd last year marked the first big event of Josue Tayub's young nursing career, a mass shooting at an El Paso Walmart.
We got a few of the patients from the shooting, and a lot of them stayed there for weeks and months.
Tayub was new to El Paso and the hospital. He helped care for some of the dozens of critically wounded patients who filled the intensive care unit. 23 people died in the largest attack targeting Latinos in U.S. history.
As a community, I mean, I was becoming part of the community, but I could tell that people were in shock and just couldn't believe what just happened.
The alleged gunman drove more than 650 miles from a Dallas suburb to carry out the attack. After his arrest, he told police he'd come to El Paso to kill Mexicans. Nurse Josue Tayub is a DACA recipient. He was born in Mexico.
So my dad was working as a gardener. So he came here to support a family, and he brought me so that I could help him support family even more.
For months now, Tayub has cared for COVID-19 patients, fighting for their lives.
Our unit is almost full with COVID patients.
He says he went into nursing to make a difference, to help underserved communities, those facing disparities in healthcare, especially Latinos. Tayub was 15 years old when he and his dad arrived in the U.S. He did not speak English. The father and son were undocumented workers in Northern California, but Tayub had big dreams and went on to graduate from high school, then college. His experience with a different kind of patient inspired him to get a nursing degree.
And at that time, I was working at a pet hospital, like helping out with surgeries and giving vaccines and drawing blood from pets. And I decided to go into the medical field, and I started taking classes to become a nurse.
By the time Tayub graduated from nursing school, he'd qualified for DACA and a work permit. He had no trouble finding a position. Tayub says he quickly had 3 competitive job offers. He chose El Paso. Frank Trinity of the Association of American Medical Colleges says that's typical. DACA recipients are desperately needed in the healthcare field, especially during the pandemic.
Not only physicians, not only nurses, but really the whole range of health professionals, from the orderlies to the respiratory therapists to the EMTs, they're all filling a critical need, and we're relying on them. And so they should not be worrying about whether they're going to lose their work reauthorization.
But that's exactly what Tayub and thousands of other people in healthcare with DACA are worrying about, on top of the risks to their own health.
And then just the thought of losing my work permit. And what if I lose my, you know, what if they rescind DACA again? And I'm not able to, you know, I might lose my insurance and I have COVID, and then what am I going to do, you know?
Miles away in the southern Mexican state of Yucatan, Tayub's mother shares those fears. With the pandemic raging, Lina Roman Martinez says she puts his fate in God's hands. She says she's proud of her son, but also deeply misses him. Traveling is tricky for DACA recipients like Tayub, who can risk their temporary legal status if they leave the U.S. He has not been back to Mexico in 11 years. Despite that separation, Tayub says he cannot envision living in Mexico again. He says home for him and others with DACA is the United States.
We want to live fear-free. So we just want to, you know, be able to work as a you know, like just like a regular citizen.
As COVID-19 cases in Texas climb, Tayub says he's focusing on his patients in the intensive care unit.
It's heartbreaking.
Even beyond the pandemic, Frank Trinity says the 30,000 healthcare workers with DACA are more essential than ever.
Many physicians are reaching retirement age right now. And so if they retire on schedule, that's going to leave a hole. In fact, we're projecting between a shortage of between 50 and more than 100,000 physicians over the next 10 years.
DACA, Trinity says, can help fill that gap for now. If the program is rolled back, Jose Tayub says he does not see how he could continue his medical career.
I love this, you know, I love this nation. So I don't want to move anywhere else. So I don't know. Like, I honestly, my plan B was to just go back and start working in like construction. I used to do construction. I used to paint houses.
The Supreme Court narrowly rejected the Trump administration's effort to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, but it's only a temporary reprieve, and many continue to live in limbo. And now, our interview with Borderland historian David Romo. He's the author of Ringside Seat to a Revolution. He's also an essayist, musician, and cultural activist. My guest co-host is Alfredo Corchado, Mexico border correspondent for the Dallas Morning News, based here in El Paso.
Oh, God, where do I start? Let's see. So El Paso, just in 1 month alone, on October 1918, had 600 deaths. That's probably an undercount. And 10,000 people contracted the so-called Spanish flu out of a total population of 75,000. And so as a borderlands historian, I like to look at the past with something that I call global microhistory. And that's just a fancy way of saying that sometimes little small events and small geographical slices of the world can give us like windows of what's going on in the rest of the world. So when I look at El Paso, I try to definitely contextualize it with the rest of the world. I mean, this was a global pandemic. It killed between 50 million to 100 million people. We don't know the exact numbers because accurate numbers weren't taken. There's a lot of questions, a lot of lessons that you can learn by looking at the micro history. But
and why was it called the Spanish flu?
All right, so it was called the Spanish flu not because it originated in Spain. Spain was a neutral country during World War II. So they were the only ones that were fully reporting on its virulence, on how it spread throughout the population. Everybody else was trying to hide that information so that it wouldn't fall into enemy hands. But that was not its origin. Actually, historians believe that the first wave of the Spanish flu took place in Haskell County, Kansas, Fort Riley to be precise. And it was a cook from a military camp there that first contracted it and spread it immediately. So that happened in early March of 1918. And very soon, within a few days, more than 1,000 soldiers, U.S. soldiers, had contracted the flu, and 46 of them died. And because of the war, you know, the U.S. military was the perfect machine to not only incubate it, but spread it throughout the world. You had 250,000 people every month, American soldiers, being transported to Europe. So really, I think that the most probable site, people don't know for sure where it started, but again, it was not Spain. It was probably the United States. And I mean, that's the official documentation that we have. We'll pin it directly to Fort Riley, Kansas. There's other theories, some theories that are based on circumstantial evidence, unproven evidence that they believe that it was Chinese laborers that were working behind the lines with the British and French armies in England and France. But I think the actual evidence all point to the United States. It came from Haskell County, Texas. Kansas.
And then spread everywhere, even if we don't know for sure. The fact of the matter is it was called Spanish flu, and information at that point was not free-flowing, so that's how that happened. What lessons? I mean, there were a lot of people. We may never know the exact death count, as you said, but many people infected with the virus, many died.
Right.
How does that relate to today? I mean, many people couldn't even imagine that, and today it seems so relevant.
There were many, many similarities. As I look at the records, and you know, I've been looking at old newspapers and death records. I've been walking through, especially this one cemetery here in El Paso, Concordia Cemetery, that has hundreds of gravestones from that period, October, November, later in 1918. And it's just amazing how similar so many things are. You know, how you connect the past with the present. The same mistakes were made back then. It seems like we don't learn from history. So on October 3rd, from October 3rd through October 6th, there was this one event, and people have mostly forgotten it. It was called Festival of the Allies. So it started off with a big monster parade, as they called it. Thousands of people, one of the largest parades in El Paso at the time. And there was also a festival, a carnival down by where the downtown library and history museum is today, Cleveland Square. And it's funny because I found an advertisement that says this is a spontaneous, entertaining, contagious fun fest that people will talk about it for years to come. And yeah, we are talking about it, not for the reason they want to. And it was very contagious. The city already knew that there was an influenza epidemic, but at the time, the mayor of the city and the health authority said, don't worry about it. People are getting, it's just another case of the flu, which sounds very similar to today and what, you know, the president of the United States said. Just as long as you stay outdoors, we're going to keep on and we're going to have this big parade, this big festival. And they did. And it was actually the president of the Red Cross, Dr. Brown, who led the parade. There were 100 children singing Onward Christian Soldiers. There were floats, dancing out in the streets. It was terribly, terribly contagious. And that was just the result of negligence on the part of the city health authorities and the city government. So that's the first, I think, instance of where we see the issue being downplayed. There was also later, so once again, it was Fort Bliss that brought it to town. The first deaths in the city were at Fort Bliss, and that was in September 30th, 1918. And very soon it spread like wildfire, like as a result of this one festival, to north of Overland Street, north of the railroad tracks, which was the predominantly Anglo section of town. And then 2 weeks later, you see it spread to what was then called Chihuahuita, which is today's South El Paso, the Segundo Barrio. And that comes after, for some reason, the Fort Bliss authorities transferred the 21st Battalion to South El Paso, what was called Camp Cotton. And within a week, it just devastated the Segundo Barrio. So it first starts at Fort Bliss, then it goes to the Anglo section of town, and then it goes to the Mexican-American section. And then it was horrendous because a lot of the children already had the whooping cough. They had, there were no hospitals, health clinics for people of South El Paso. So they established a temporary hospital, the Red Cross did, at it. Aoi School, and they turned the school into, they brought in hospital beds. A lot of the Southsiders were afraid to go to the hospital. There had actually been rumors, and I think this is real fascinating, that they were being injected with poisonous serums. So that really concerned the Fort Bliss authority. The commanding general there said, you know, we're going to have our military intelligence division figure out if it, these are German spies, German propaganda agents stationed in Juarez that are actually spreading these rumors. So, I mean, when you talk about this micro history, there's a whole world of history and trajectories going on, right? But not everybody in South El Paso, of course, stayed away from the hospital. There was a lot of support, and there were a lot of volunteers, the women of the Segundo Barrio especially. They would go out there and feed, you know, they would bring in broth, there was a bakery store, and they would give free, you know, bread to the patients. There was especially women that volunteered as nurses that lost their lives because they volunteered. They contracted influenza, too. There was a lot of courage. So there's all kinds of stories that kind of remind us very much of what's going on right now. And it wasn't until things really got out of control that the city decided to take kind of social distancing measures, very similar to the ones today. So all public spaces were closed, the movie theaters, businesses had to have a limit, only a certain amount of people could go in. They didn't enforce a mask like in other cities, like in Tucson and San Francisco. So we didn't have the fights here that are going on today. There's, in San Francisco, they had the anti-mask committee, for instance. People were saying that the masks and social distancing measures were violating their constitutional rights. So a lot of similarities, both at the local level and what's going on at the national level.
David, I'm curious, what were the politics like in the city of El Paso? What was cooperation like between El Paso Juarez? This is before a wall. This is before there was even a Border Patrol agency. I think there was a role also of the KKK in town.
Yeah. So, I mean, of course, in my book, I looked a lot at the incident called the Bath Riots, in which in 1917, so I'm talking about a year before the outbreak of the influenza, you had these sensationalized headlines about the typhus scare. There was an epidemic of typhus in central Mexico at the time. So Mayor Tom Lee Sr., the mayor of El Paso, also John Pershing, the commander of Fort Bliss, and Dr. Kaplan, who was the head of the U.S. Public Health Service, they decided that they were going to do a cleanup campaign in Segundo Barrio in South El Paso. And so they demolished hundreds of homes. They would go into homes, and if they found anybody with lice, they would force men, women, and children to shave their heads. They would fumigate their homes. All of this was part of this idea that they needed to protect themselves from typhus that was coming across the border from Mexico. And so you know, people now know about those very draconian and humiliating fumigations at the Santa Fe International Bridge, where people had to strip naked and take baths with kerosene. And they found lice on their head. So all of that was very draconian, and it had basically the public health policy was very much racialized. So you see a stark difference between what happens during this typhus scare and what happens during the influenza. Because I found this, I just came across this very recently. So in late September, a few days before this Festival of the Allies and before the outbreak of influenza in 1918, Dr. Tappan of the U.S. Public Service, he says, we have just gotten information that there's one case of typhus and what is, we have to reinstitute these fumigations, these baths. And we're talking a year after the bath riots. So there's a huge congregation of protesters in what is, and Tappan and other officials, they fear a repetition of the bath riots where 2,000 women revolted a year previously. And so they rescind the order. And the same thing with another like real interesting tidbit is that you had Mayor Tom Lee Sr., and he was the one that was responsible for bringing in the quarantine and the fumigations. And he used to be so deadly afraid of contracting the typhus lies that he used to wear silk underwear. Now, he contracts the virus. He's sick in bed. He and his son, Tom Lee Jr., were sick with the so-called Spanish flu. And you never heard them say anything about protecting themselves from a virus that comes from within the borders of the United States. Quite the opposite. So you had this very contagious event going on, and the mayor of the city says there is no fear for alarm. He says, you know, this is outdoors. It's not going to create contagion. The only thing he actually outlaws is these miniature dusters. And that was because they're feathers that you can tickle people's noses and people might sneeze, which is just for me, just very ironic. So you have city and health officials telling the populace there's no cause for alarm when the first or the second, we don't know if it was more deadly than the Black Plague. We don't have the exact numbers, but it may have been the absolute most deadly pandemic in the history of the world is about to take place, and the El Paso authorities tell people, don't worry about it. What? And then you have one case of influenza, and you have these hugely draconian measures of, you know, spraying people with noxious chemicals. Measures that continue for decades after, right, with the braceros. You have millions of people going through these disinfections with DDT. So you see the stark contrast there. If the origin of the disease is perceived to be foreign, then you have a public response that borders on hysteria. But if it's perceived to be domestic, then your response borders on negligence. So that, I think that's one of the major lessons of history that we get from the Spanish flu.
With the key word being borders, and you covered some of that, but what did it and does it say about borders now? I mean, a lot of times fear of the other or the foreigner is tied closely to concerns about diseases or, and you know, pandemics.
Yeah, you know, and that's, in a sense, that's just been part of the perennial universal history. It's not just in the United States that, I mean, look at the history of the Spanish flu and its different names. It was also called the Spanish Lady. So the U.S. authorities would come up with the possibility that the influenza had been created in a laboratory, and we're talking about 1918, with the same similar ideas are going on today. But it was created in a lab as part of bacteriological warfare by the Germans. The Germans, in turn, called it the Russian pest. The Russians called it the Chinese disease. And the white South Africans called it the black man's plague. And people in Spain, who were very upset that it was being called the Spanish flu, said, wait a minute, maybe it should be called the American flu. It's so prevalent in America. And they were actually right. If anything, the most appropriate name for what was called the Spanish flu back then was the American flu, because all the evidence points that its origin was here within its borders. So I think you always see that. You see the stigmatization, the use. Diseases are not just scientific. They're also political. And you use them for your own political agenda. You use them to stigmatize the other. And you also have this idea of the shock doctrine, that you use the situation of distress and crisis to bring about kind of political agendas that you already wanted to create. And it's just the crisis just gives you an excuse to carry out, you know, xenophobic agendas, all kinds of what you wanted to do anyway. So it's this idea of, I think Naomi Klein captures it very well, of the shock doctrine. You use shock situations to impose very kind of repressive, draconian measures on the populace.
Oh, in the lockdown, I found a lot of time to read, and this is a book, Ringside Seat to a Revolution, is a must-read book to understand pandemic, especially if you're on the border, understand what happens on the border. Shout out to Cinco Puntos Press. But my last question, David, is what have we learned about walls and pandemics? I mean, it's always been the fear of the others, as Angela just asked. I mean, walls keep viruses out. Will this be a more vocal call for building more walls? What happens now?
Well, walls are completely useless to contain pandemics. And well, the lesson of the 1918 pandemic is that we were so kind of focused on keeping out contagions that come from outside our walls that we totally lost sight of the contagious outbreaks that come within our walls. And I think that doesn't only go for pandemics, it goes for kind of social situations, violence, what have you. There is no disconnect between them and us. I mean, in the case of the United States, the so-called protectors that were going to fight the war, to end all wars, bring democracy, I'm talking about the U.S. military forces, they ended up being the most deadly force in the history of pandemics. They were the ones that were the vectors. They were the ones that incubated. They were the ones that spread it out to the rest of the world. So sometimes we have to look at ourselves. We think we're the country that needs to protect itself from others. But the truth is that it's others that need to protect themselves from us. I think that's the most important lesson.
Well, thank you, David. That's a great point to end on, and appreciate your time and sharing your insights, historic and what it means now. And we've been speaking with David Romo, author and historian, specializing in border studies and author to that great book, Ringside Seat to a Revolution.
Thank you very much, David.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It was an honor.
Thank you for listening to The Weekend, and thank you to our audio engineer, Sam Cassiano. This is KTEP 88.5 FM, your NPR station for the Southwest.